I'll begin reading Acts 14, verse 8. And in Lystra, a certain man without strength in his feet was sitting, a cripple from his mother's womb, who had never walked. This man heard Paul speaking. Paul, observing him intently and seeing that he had faith to be healed, said with a loud voice, "Stand up straight on your feet." And he leaped and walked. Now when the people saw what Paul had done, they raised their voices, saying in the Lyconian language, "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of man." And Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. Then the priest of Zeus, whose temple was in front of their city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates, intending to sacrifice with the multitudes. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard this, they tore their clothes and ran in among the multitude, crying out and saying, "Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the same nature as you, and preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God, who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that are in them, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness." And with these sayings, they could scarcely restrain the multitudes from sacrificing to them. Then, Jews from Antioch and Iconium came there, and having persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. However, when the disciples gathered around him, he rose up and went into the city, and the next day he departed with Barnabas to Derbe. We are looking at Paul's first missionary journey. Paul and Barnabas left Antioch of Syria. They went to Cyprus. Then they went to Antioch in Pisidia. This is all on our map. Last week we saw them travel to Iconium, where the Jews stirred up the Gentiles and they plotted to stone Paul and Barnabas. But they heard about it, so they left and they went to Lystra, right there. And they preached there. Ordinarily, Paul and Barnabas, first thing they had to do is what? Go to the synagogue of the Jews. But there is no mention here of the synagogue. Probably was none. Probably, it's very possible this place was not the biggest place in the world. Probably didn't have a large Jewish population. Paul did not start by saying, "Hey everyone, guess what, the Messiah is here, the son of David is here," or anything like that. They wouldn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't do that. Rather, we find him outside, maybe in the marketplace or something like that, and he's preaching to these Lyconians. And Luke starts us off with an account of a miracle. Now, Paul has done many miracles before. Just in Iconium, we read that they did a number of miracles. But this is the first recorded specific miracle that we read from the Apostle Paul, where he heals a man who is lame. And in verse 8, as we go through our text, Luke basically tells us about this man. He tells us the same thing three times. He starts off and he says, "In Lystra, a certain man without strength in his feet was sitting." And you're like, okay, I get it. And he's like, no. He was a cripple from his mother's womb. Okay, I understand. No. Who had never walked. You get it now? Okay, we get it. Yes. This man is in a desperate situation, helpless condition, has never walked. Okay, what happens? Verse 9. This man heard Paul speaking. Paul, observing him intently and seeing that he had faith to be healed, said with a loud voice, "Stand up straight on your feet." And he leaped and walked. So Paul is preaching to this crowd. I don't know if there was a crowd gathered. Maybe they're just kind of walking by. I don't know. But there is this one man who's listening. And Paul sees him. And it says he had faith to be healed. Some have suggested, I have no clue, I'm just saying, some have suggested that perhaps Paul was telling of accounts where Jesus had healed people or something like that. And this man believed and was like, "Oh, I wish Jesus was here to heal me." I don't know, it doesn't say that, but it's a possibility. But for some, in some way, I don't know how, Paul understands that this person believes, and he believes that he could be healed. Did the Holy Spirit tell him? I don't know. But this man believes that Jesus has the power to heal him. And so Paul, with the power of the Holy Spirit, with the power of Jesus Christ, obviously, turns to this man and he says, get up! And let me tell you something that I love about all the healing miracles in the Bible. You don't see slow, I'm not sure if I can do this. You know, how does this guy even know how to walk? How does he even know how to balance? There's no months of physiotherapy or anything like that. You know, we sit down here for an hour in a comfortable chair and we get up and knees crack and pop and stuff. This guy has never walked. And Paul says, get up, and he leaps up and walks. Okay? I don't know how old this man was. I don't know for how many years he was crippled. It doesn't matter. He's a man. And he just jumps up instantly. That's the power of Christ. For God, nothing is impossible. Okay? Now, having seen that, Luke does not spend a lot of time on this. There are other passages where the whole focus of the passage is the miracle. Not here. The only reason he mentions this miracle is not to get into what happened with him, but to, because he wants to get to what occurred because of the miracle. Alright? So this is what happens. Verse 11. It says, now when the people saw what Paul had done, they raised their voices, saying in the Lyconian language, the gods have come down to us in the likeness of men. And Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. Now, keep in mind, Paul has been preaching in Greek. Alright? Greek was what we call the lingua franca of the Roman Empire. It was the language that people used who did not have a common language. Like we speak English today. There are people here whose first language is not English, but we use English because that's the common language for everyone. Well, back then in the Roman Empire, everyone may have had their own native language, but they also spoke Greek. So Paul is preaching in Greek. And so these people from Lystra, they're Lyconian, and so they have their Lyconian language, but they also understand Greek. Paul and Barnabas do not speak Lyconian. This is going to be important as the story goes on. All right, so they see the miracle, and they say, the gods have come down to us. In Lyconian, they say, the gods have come down to us. Now, keep in mind, when they say they've come down, it's not from heaven, because the gods didn't live in heaven. They lived on Mount Olympus. So they've come down from the mountain, okay, in the form of men. And they call Barnabas Zeus, and they call Paul Hermes. In the King James, it says, I don't know if any of you are reading the King James right now, it says Barnabas they called Jupiter, and Paul they called Mercury, or Mercurius. All right, the Greek text says Zeus and Hermes, because those are the Greek names of the gods, but the Romans had the equivalent. You have Aphrodite, who's Venus, and you have Poseidon, who's Neptune, and stuff like that. But, okay, so they say, okay, Zeus and Hermes. And they say, why do they call Paul Hermes? Because, it says, he was the chief speaker. You're like, well, so what? Well, because Hermes was the messenger of the gods, and so he would be the guy speaking. He goes, back then, what you had was they assigned to different gods different areas of life. You had your god of war, and your god of wisdom, and your god of love, and your god of agriculture, and all these things. And you say, well, thank goodness, we don't have those kind of superstitions anymore. We all believe now in one true God who is over all, right? Yet, in how many churches today, there are people, they don't say there are many gods, but they have many saints who are over certain aspects of life, and that's why you have Saint Nicholas, who is the protector of sailors, and you have Saint George, who's the protector of the army, and you have Saint whatever, who's the protector of something else. And this is all superstition and idolatry. Because people sit and they pray to these dead people when they should only be praying to God. But let's keep on going. Another reason, this is interesting. Another reason why they may call these two Zeus and Hermes. Why do they come up with these two specific deities? Well, in ancient mythology, there was this very interesting story. There was this story that, because many times in ancient mythology, the gods came down in the form of man. There was this specific story that took place in this same region. Okay, not a true story, it's a myth, but it took place in the same region where indeed Zeus and Hermes came down. And they looked for hospitality. And they went to 1,000 homes. And no one opened the door to them. Finally, they went to the home of this poor elderly couple that let them in and gave them food and wine and all these things. And because of this goodness to them, Zeus and Hermes took this elderly couple and they protected them and they took them up onto a mountain. And they sent a flood which destroyed the rest of the valley because those people were so wicked and inhospitable to them. Now, it's very possible that these people would know this story because it was a story that supposedly took place in their own region. So now, they see these two strangers that have come out of nowhere and they do something supernatural. And they're thinking, oh no, they're back. And we better be nice to them this time, because last time they were here, they destroyed us all for not being nice to them. Maybe. Just a thought. It's possible. It's possible. And so what do? They want to worship them. They want to worship them and give them the honor that is due to them. And look at verse 13. Then the priest of Zeus, whose temple was under their city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates, intending to sacrifice with the multitudes. Here, this guy with the oxen, flowers all around it, and like, let's kill it. Sacrifice it to these people. All right. Well, and Paul and Barnabas, up until this point, they hadn't figured out what's going on until they see the guy with the bull ready to sacrifice, and they're like, oh, No. We thought they were just excited because they saw a miracle. That's not what's going on here. This is what happens. Verse 14. But when the apostles, Barnabas and Paul, heard this, they tore their clothes and ran in among the multitude, crying out and saying, men, why are you doing these things? Let's stop right there for a moment. They realize what's going on. They tear their clothes. Doesn't mean they tore everything. They would grab up here and pull down and rip it. And it was a sign of great displeasure. People would do this when they saw an abomination, where there was some blasphemy going on. Do you remember during Jesus's trial, we'll call it a trial, it wasn't really, but during Jesus' trial, the high priest says to Jesus, I put you under oath. Tell me right now, are you the Son of God? And Jesus says, it is as you say. And it says the high priest tore his clothes. It was like, oh, blasphemy. That's what they did. They tore their clothes when they saw something that they couldn't stand, that it was so outrageous. Of course, Jesus wasn't blaspheming, but here these people are. These people have grown up in Judaism. They didn't have idolatry. They didn't have any of these things. And so, I mean, in their time at least, in the past they did. But and so they can't handle this kind of idolatry. So they tear their clothes. And they're horrified. And they go in and they say, stop. Please, just stop what you're doing. And I can't help but think, but wonder, I wonder what Paul and Barnabas would think if they knew that centuries later, not pagans like this, but people who call themselves Christians, people who have been baptized in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, would be bowing down and kissing images of them, of Paul and Barnabas. I wonder what they would think of that. Anyhow, they run into the crowd. What do they say? So they say, verse 15, they say, men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the same nature as you. Stop right there. He says, we are anthropi. He doesn't, where it says we are men. Okay. Andres is men. Anthropi means human beings. He's not saying we are men as in contrast to women. He's saying we are human beings as in contrast to gods. We're not gods. We're human beings with the same nature as you. And he says, and we preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all the things that are in them. From this point on, what we have is Paul's first recorded message. It's not really a sermon. It's just a couple of verses. It's not really a sermon, but it's Paul's first message to a full-blown pagan audience. There's no Jews here. You know, he doesn't go around saying the Messiah has come, look what the scriptures say. He doesn't do anything like that. And he doesn't even get around in this specific situation. Keep in mind there's a crowd going on, there's crazies, they're trying to calm him down. So he doesn't even get to talking about Jesus, actually. He's going to get there later on. But the first thing that he needs to do is he needs to turn them from their pagan gods to know that there is one true God. First thing that he needs to do. And that's what he does here. So he says to them, turn from these useless things, the matea, these vanities, talking about their idols and their idolatrous religion, turn from these vanities to the true God. And you could say, wait a minute there, Paul. You got to be careful there. You can't just go into someone's city and talk about their religion and say, turn from these useless things. We were born in this religion. We've grown up in this religion. Our fathers had this religion. This is our tradition. This is our culture. And here you go, going in saying, turn from these useless things, our gods. Yeah, that's what he does. He says they are. They're useless. They don't exist. They're nothing. They're not real. You realize that Zeus and Hermes don't exist. They're not real. All you have is a statue. A statue with eyes that don't see and ears that don't hear and a mouth that can't speak. It's useless. It's pointless. It's worthless. You're wasting your time. You're wasting your life worshiping nothingness. Rather, he says, turn to the living God. And the first thing that he has to say about this true living God is what? That he's the creator. Creation. That's what pagans need to hear. Pagans need to hear that God is their creator. And which means that they are his creatures, which means, therefore, that they are accountable to him. Have you noticed we have a lot of pagans around who do not believe that God is their creator? We just kind of, you know, the universe just kind of came about by chance. The world just kind of came about by chance. Life is just, it just happened, and we die and go back into nothingness. No. Paul says, no, there is a God. He created everything. He created seas and sky and the earth and everything that is in them. And you need to turn to him and worship him. Look at verse 16. Speaking of God, it says, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. This is interesting here. I want you to realize here that he is drawing a distinction between, in the Old Testament times, between Israel and the rest of the nations. Because if he was talking to Jews, he wouldn't say this. Do you remember in Pisidian Antioch when he was in the synagogue and he was talking to Jews, first thing that he said was what? He didn't say God in past times let you go your own way and do your own thing. No. He said God chose our fathers. He chose Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He sent prophets. He gave us the law. He gave us scriptures. He did not leave Israel to go do their own thing. The rest of the nations, though, he said, in the past, he just let them go. He did not treat them the same way. Did God treat the Egyptians the same way that he treated the Israelites? He did not. Did God treat the Canaanites the same way that he treated the Israelites? He did not. God treated Israel in a certain way, not because they were any better than everyone else. That's what they thought. That's not the reason. But because God had his own purposes and promises that he needed to fulfill. And so, Paul says God allowed you in times past to just go your own way. All nations, just do whatever. It doesn't mean that he was indifferent. It doesn't mean that he was okay with it. But he put up with it. He suffered it. He didn't destroy you all for just following these idols. Paul does not elaborate on this here because this is so short. In Acts 17, where Paul's going to be in Athens, he's talking to the Athenians, again, a group of purely pagans, and he basically says the same thing, but he elaborates on it, and he says, again, in times past, God let you just go your own way, do your own thing, but now, he commands everyone everywhere to repent. Okay? In the Old Testament, God was specifically working with Israel. And he let the other nations just do their own thing. But now, no more. Now the gospel is going out to all nations. You've got to keep that in mind. Now, here's where we got something important. At this point, these Gentiles may be thinking, well, if God did not give us any special revelation, he didn't give us the scriptures, he didn't send us prophets, that means that we're not accountable. How many people today will say, well, all these people, if God just let them do their own thing and God didn't choose them and try to deal with them specifically as he did with Israel, then, you know, if he didn't tell them, then it's not their fault for not believing. If they didn't hear it, how could they believe? Therefore, they would say, well, they're innocent. Look at what Paul says here. Verse 17. He says, Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. He says, God did not leave you completely to your own ways. He did leave a witness. And this is basically the same thing that Paul says in Romans 1. This is very important. I want you to go see this. Please turn to the book of Romans in chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. Really quick, remind you of the context so you know what's going on here. Paul wants to explain the gospel. And he's going to get around to doing that in chapters 3 and 4. But before he explains the gospel, he needs to let everyone know, he wants to establish the fact that all people everywhere are sinners and guilty before God. That's his purpose in the first 2.5 chapters. Once we establish that everyone is guilty and a sinner before God, then we can give them the good news that Christ has died for us. Okay? And so in chapter 1, he deals with the nations and the pagans and their idolatries. Then in chapter 2, he deals with the Jews. He says, you think you're any better than the Gentiles just because you had the law? Well, you would be if you kept the law, but you didn't, so you're not any better. Okay? So he finally gets to chapter 3 and he sums it all up and he says, there is no one righteous. There is no one good. There is no one that seeks after God. All have gone their own way. All have gone astray. There's no one good, no, not one. And that's why everyone needs Christ. Okay, that's the context. So, in chapter 1, he's talking about the nations. And he's trying to establish the fact that they are also sinners and guilty and therefore need to be saved by Christ. Look at what he says in verse 18. Romans 1, verse 18. He says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth. So they have the truth. They suppress the truth in unrighteousness because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. He says, listen, these, all the nations, they know, they had the truth and they suppressed it in unrighteousness. There were things that they could know about God because God has shown them. Well, what is that? Look at verse 20. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen. How? Being understood by the things that are made. Even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Everyone in the world can see creation. They can see the things that are made. They can see that there is an all-powerful God who made everything. They can see the sun, moon, the stars, the seas, the mountains, the animals, people, life. And they know that these things were made by God. I don't care if you live in a village somewhere. I don't care if you live on a desert island. I don't care if you live in the jungle. You know that there is a God who created everything. And Paul says, therefore, everyone is without excuse. If they reject God and make idols instead, they are without excuse. Look at verse 21. He says, because although they knew God, you see that? Although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. They knew God, but they did not worship Him. Instead, what did they do? They made idols. People say today, look, Nico, you have all these people. In ancient times, far away from Israel, they didn't know. They had very little light. They had very little knowledge. So the best they could do, they saw the sun, they saw the moon, they saw these things. And so they made, you know, images that represented these things and bowed down to them. That's all they had. That's all they knew. Is that not good enough? And Paul says, no, it's not good enough. Idolatry is not good enough. That's his whole point. There are people who say, if people have never heard, then God cannot hold them accountable. And this is a big thing between Christians. Divides them, I know. Now, there's a lot that can be said about this. But let me just say one thing. One thing. Let's think about this for a moment. If we're going to say, anyone who has never heard is not accountable, they get a free pass to heaven. Let's assume that everyone who has never heard gets a free pass to heaven. That means that the worst thing that you can do, the worst thing that you can do is give them the gospel. Because now, they may hear it, reject it, and end up in hell. Right? If... Think about the people in Lystra. Again, assume that these people automatically already on their way to heaven because they've never heard of Christ. You're thinking, thanks a lot, church in Antioch, for sending missionaries. Thanks a lot, Paul and Barnabas. We were doing fine. We were on our way to heaven, and now you have come, you've given us the gospel, and if we don't believe it, we're going to end up in hell. Well, before, we were going to heaven. If it's true, I can't stress this enough, if it's true that you automatically go to heaven if you have not heard, then the most loving thing that Paul could have done was stand up before these idolaters and said, okay, has anyone here heard of Jesus? No? Great. I'm leaving. And if anyone ever shows up and tries to tell you about Jesus, close your ears. Kick them out of town. Because they're going to give you a message that if you don't believe it, potentially you're going to go to hell. And we don't want that. We want you to go to heaven. So, we're leaving. Paul, in Romans 1, says, no, people know that there is a God. Everyone knows that there is a God, and therefore it would be our responsibility to seek that one true God, but no one does that. Instead, they made idols, and therefore they're guilty, and therefore accountable. And if you go back to Acts 14, please go back to Acts, that's the same point. He's not as harsh here. He's a bit softer here, but his point is the same. He's talking to the Lystrians, verse 17, and he says, nevertheless, he did not leave himself without a witness. What did he do? He did good. He gave us rain. God gave you rain from heaven for your crops. Where did you get food from? Did you create it on your own? No. Where did you get rain from? God gave you rain, and therefore you have crops, and therefore you have food. You know that there's a God. Come on. You know that these idols are just stone. You know that there's a true God. And therefore, you are accountable. And so turn, this, it's a short lesson, but he says turn from these idols to the living God. Verse 18, and with these sayings, they could scarcely restrain the multitudes from sacrificing to them. They still weren't quite sure. They're like, I don't know. Maybe it's a trick. Maybe they're testing us or something. The gods, no. But they were able somehow to stop them. Now, before we close, there's a two-verse paragraph that tells us how things turned out later in Lystra. This is not immediately at that moment, but probably not too long after that. Before we read it, remember last week I said to you that primarily in the early church, those who persecuted Christians were the Jews. And you say, well, there aren't any Jews in Lystra. Maybe a few, but not many. So they're safe there, right? No. Look at verse 19. Then Jews from Antioch and Iconium, the two places that he had been, came there, and having persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. It's interesting how back when Paul was not a Christian yet, when he was this zealous Pharisee, he was not content with persecuting Christians in Jerusalem. He wanted to go to other cities and chase after them there, like when he was going to Damascus. And here you have people who are doing the same. We are not content to kick Paul out of town. We are going to follow him where he... This is far away. This is not close. These are miles, dozens of miles to get to Lystra. And they follow him to find him. And you remember last week in Iconium, it says that the Jews poisoned the minds of the Gentiles against them. So it seems they pretty much do the same thing. And now these people who not too long ago wanted to worship them, they're like, oh, so they're a bunch of imposters? And so they all get together and they stone him. They stone him. They wanted to stone him back in Iconium. That was the plan. They get to Lystra and now they do stone him. I'm not going to get into stoning right now. But he's knocked unconscious and people think that he's dead and they drag his body outside of the city and dump him there. Some have suggested that Paul actually died here and that God raised him from the dead. The text doesn't say that. It says they thought he was dead, but it doesn't say he was dead. It says he was stoned and they thought he was dead. Paul mentions the stoning later on, by the way. Do you remember the passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 11? You don't have to go there. But where he's talking about all the things that he's gone through in his ministry, and I've been beaten and I've been imprisoned, and he says, five times by the Jews I've gotten the 39 lashes, and three times I've been beaten with rods, and he says, and one time I was stoned. That's right here in Lystra. So verse 20 says, however, when the disciples gathered around him, he rose up and went into the city. And the next day he departed with Barnabas to Derbe. Notice there are some disciples there. Something that we don't realize because we just keep seeing opposition and idolatry and stoning and chasing and all these things. Realize that everywhere he went, there were people who believed. There were churches that started in these places. That's where when he's going to write to the churches in Galatia, these are the ones. All right, so there were people who believed. And so you have the disciples who are sitting over what maybe they also think it's a dead body. And he wakes up. And he goes back into the city. I'm sure he has cuts. He has bruises. He probably has broken bones. This man has been stoned, okay? I didn't get into stoning, but you can picture it. We're not talking about throwing little stones. We're just talking about throwing rocks. It's like throwing bricks. You're trying to kill the person, okay? And so, either it's a miracle or we have one tough Christian here. But he gets up and he goes back into the city. And says, and the next day, he and Barnabas departed to go to Derbe. I don't think it's it's an accident where he says the next day. Now, if I had been stoned the previous day, I'd probably be thinking of retiring or something. And the disciples, I'm sure, were saying, "Paul, just take a couple of weeks off or something. You got stoned." But nope, he gets up the next day and he walks 50 kilometers. Probably took a couple of days to get to Derby. Over 50 kilometers to get to Derby. And he's not going there for vacation. He's going to go, and the first thing that he does when he gets there is he's going to preach the gospel again. I'm just amazed with the zeal and the endurance of this man. I mean, you have Christians today who are like, "Oh, you know, I don't know if I'm going to go to church tomorrow because it's hot. It's raining and I'm going to need an umbrella." This man is stoned. And the next day, back to the ministry. Back into the ministry. He has been persecuted in Antioch. He has been persecuted in Iconium. He has been stoned in Lystra. And he keeps on going. He does not stop. Why? Why does he not stop? Because for him, souls of people are more important than his own comfort. He understands people need to hear the gospel. What did he say? "I am not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation." This is how people get saved. What did he said, "This is a faithful saying and worthy of all acceptance, that Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners." People need to hear this. He understood that all people are sinners and they need to hear the gospel. That is their only hope, and so he would not stop, no matter what. And so I pray, we should pray, that be more like Paul. Be to have that kind of love for people, that kind of zeal for the glory of God, and that kind of zeal to give people the good news. I pray that we would be like that. Let's pray.